Welcome back to class tonight. Tonight is the finale of our three sessions. We're covering a lot of ground in a hurry. As we're doing whatever work we are called to do, we'd do it with all of our heart as though we are serving the Lord. Now, that very idea of engaging the cultural mandate, of every single individual engaging the cultural mandate in whatever it is that they happen to be doing, assumes a kind of inequality in that, in the sense that not everyone is going to be doing the exact same thing. The specific gifts and abilities that he has given one individual are expressed as he puts those to work for God's glory and the other individuals as well, although they're going to be various things, they're going to be different things. And so one could assume a certain element of inequality in those things, meaning not that one is more valuable than the other necessarily in God's eyes or to his glory, one glorifies him more than another, but that they are not identical, they're not the same. God uses different people in different ways. So that's the first force that is evident in the economy, and we see that in so many ways all around us. One of the things that Kuyper was so keen about and mentioned several times, especially in his Stone lectures, was that the American experience took or was the opportunity for so much of that which God had put inside mankind to come out. And so the long list of innovations and inventions and the continual growth of prosperity in America, he saw as a clear extension of this image of God in mankind, that here people had the freedom and opportunity to put it to work, and because of that, the economy of America, not just the economy of America, but all of society, prospered greatly. The second force that's always at work in the economy is the survival force. And that is the case, of course, because of the curse. No longer is our engagement with the world simply an engagement of glorifying God, of using the gifts that he has given us to bring glory to him. Now there's another wrinkle in that need that we have to engage the world, and that is that it now becomes a need, a critical need. The curse brings about a situation where we are now in a genuine struggle to survive. Now, we in the United States in the current day and age don't feel that to the same extent that many people around the world feel it every day. And many people here have felt that in days gone by. Many people obviously do feel it at any given time. More and more, it seems these days, people feeling the extreme pinch of what it's like to suddenly be without work, without the ability to engage in something of value for other people, not able to provide for their needs, and suddenly feeling the intensity of the reality that this is a struggle for survival. If you're not able to supply your needs, you don't have the things that you need for basic sustenance to support your life. This is related to one of the most favorite words that modern economists use, and that is the idea of scarcity. There simply isn't enough of everything for everyone to have all that they want at any given point in time. That's because of many different things, but principally it is because of the curse, of the way in which creation is in bondage to decay, and that while we are working with the world to create, to create not only food, but lots of other things as well, the earth is in a sense working against us. And so it is only by the sweat of our brow that these things exist. And so if we should stop that engagement, stop the work that we are engaged in, things become very scarce very quickly. So that leads to collaboration. We talked about this a little bit last week, that because some of us are good at certain things and others of us are good at other things, some of us focus our time to do the things that we're good at, and we rely on others to do the things that they are good at, and we are relying on them now, not just to watch the way in which they're going to glorify God, but we're dependent on them to do things that we don't do so well. I need other people to do things that I don't do so well, and they need me to do things that they don't do so well, and together we share in this struggle against the curse. So we have not only collaboration, but cooperation. We see that we all need to be on the same team, essentially, because we are all in this shared struggle. So what examples do we have of that survival force at work in the economy at any given point? One of those things is something that I just mentioned, which is the division of labor or specialization. We're sort of, in a sense, forced into that. I mean, we could all try to supply all of our needs on our own little plot of ground, but that isn't terribly, it doesn't work out so well. As I said, not only because some of us aren't so good at that part, but because our needs are very extensive. And having enough time and enough resources to individually create all of those things would be a significant drag on our ability to exist and certainly to thrive. There's an attitude, you know, when you talk about somebody's job and they say something like, well, it's a living. That's not part of the cultural mandate, that idea or that attitude of, hey, you know, I'm just going to do what I have to survive. But that idea does come into play with the onset of the curse and the struggle to survive. But the other thing that's very important for us to see that is a component piece of this survival force is the reality of the existence of competition in the marketplace. Competition. Now, how do you think that competition might be an extension of the survival force? Companies cannot hire everybody. We get, companies get, if they have five openings, they may get 50 applications or 500 applications. So there's not this idea of there not being enough for everyone. There's not enough work, say, at one particular employer to employ everyone who might want to work there. Okay. How else does competition grow from this idea of the struggle, the survival force? Okay. Competition is necessary because not only are we all struggling to survive in general, but each individual who happens to be in a particular industry or a particular line of work is struggling to survive against others who are in that same line of work. So competition is part of the survival force in that if an individual who is a farmer, for example, or is a grocer, he is daily living with this reality that if they do not pay particular attention to all of the costs that they have, and that they are not paying particular attention to the desires of the market or of the customers that they have, they are not going to be able to survive. Because why is that you need to be paying so much attention to the costs that are involved in your particular industry or line of work, and you need to be paying so much attention to the desires of the customers in your particular line of work in order to survive? Why is that? Why isn't it just that you can spend as much money as you want in your particular field and you can charge as much as you want in your particular field? Why can't it just be that way? Right, you have competition from another company, but why do we have to have competition from another company? Why can't every company simply set whatever prices they want and say, this is how much you're going to have to pay for it? Okay, the demand might go down. People would stop buying it from you, right? But why? Why would people stop buying it from you if that was your attitude toward your particular line of work? Okay, so you're not only competing against other pizza makers, you're competing against the hot dog vendor, you're competing against a lot of other people who are supplying a similar type thing that you could go with otherwise. But why is it that we cannot set our prices at whatever level we want and just say, I'm sorry, that's how much it's going to cost, and you're going to have to pay that much? How does the consumer, the consumer determines the value. Say more about that. How is it that the consumer determines the value? Okay, and why are they concerned about what your service is worth? Well, they have other choices for that same dollar, but why is that such a big deal that they have other choices for that same dollar? We're all trying to survive, exactly right. It's not just the business owner who's trying to survive. All of the customers are trying to survive as well. Everyone out in the market is saying, I have to survive. And in order for me to survive, not just as a business owner, as a pizza store owner, or as a farmer, or as whatever it is, I have to keep my costs down, I have to keep my quality up, so that I can keep my prices as low as possible in order to compete, because everybody that I'm selling to doesn't have as much money as they want to have either. So everyone in an economy is having to economize. It's necessary. Why is it necessary? It's necessary because of the survival force, which is there because of the curse. So whether we're running a business or running a household, we still concern ourselves with the same things every day. How can I keep my costs low as possible, so that I can make ends meet, have something left at the end of the day, be able to meet my needs, again, whether those are as a business owner or as an individual. So competition. Competition means that value is paramount, and we talked about that. Someone mentioned that it's the value. I think, Mike, you said that the customer determines the value, right? The customer determines the value on what basis? Do they just arbitrarily say, I think a pizza is worth whatever? Or do they look at their income and they say, you know what, I'm willing to spend X amount of the money that I have on any given week for dinner on Wednesday night, and that money is going to go somewhere. This is how much I'm willing to pay for a pizza. So the prices, the value of something is determined by the customer, because they're the ones in a position to be able to judge how much it means to them, because they too are engaged in this struggle against the curse, or having to deal daily with this survival force. They realize that if they don't do these things, they will not survive. Businesses don't survive if they do not keep their costs down and their quality up. They simply don't survive. And households don't survive either if they don't keep their costs down low enough to be below what they're taking in. It's a little bit different situation, but the basic principles are the same. So because value is of such paramount importance in the economy, because of this survival force, things like honest weights and measures are critically important. We talked about this last week when we talked about currency, and that the critical importance that everyone understands there is a known value to this currency which stands in place of some good or service. When you bring currency somewhere, everybody has to understand what that currency is worth and agree to that, and not have it just changing by the day, in order that they can exchange things, in order that they can make a decision and say, yes, this is in my best interest, I am prepared to spend this amount of money on that good or service. Okay? So that honest weights and measures and the stable kinds of currency are very important for an economy to be able to move, for people to be able to make those decisions with knowledge. So, as I said a moment ago, scarcity demands economy or economizing. There would be no need for what we call economics or an economy if there was not scarcity, and there would not be scarcity without the curse. An economy means that things must be economized because they have alternate uses. My money has to be economized because I have lots of things that I have to pay for. Now, this competition presents a situation or creates a situation that is best for the whole. Why is it that this kind of open competition is best for the whole? We've already touched on it. Because everybody out there, when you go somewhere, I don't care what you're looking for. You need to go buy a new pair of jeans, or you need to go buy dinner, or you need to go buy groceries, or you need to go buy whatever. You are going to be making determinations based on value, and you are going to want to spend the least amount of money for the highest quality. You are. Even just by virtue of your desire to be a good steward of what you have. You want to do that. Now, there are some other aspects of that that may come into play, but they're also economic in nature in terms of why you might choose one store over another. There are other things simply besides price and quality, or at least quality is more extensive than just the quality of the good itself. Maybe the quality of the store that you're in, or the quality of the service that is provided for you there, whatever it happens to be. But you're still making value judgments. But anyway, this open struggle against the curse, where we are all doing our best to economize out of necessity, it is best for everyone because, as Sarah was mentioning earlier, when there is competition, quality is forced up and costs are forced down. Necessarily. Always. Now, what happens in an economy when there are prices that are set arbitrarily high? What naturally happens in any kind of economy when certain prices for certain things are set arbitrarily high? What's the effect on the people in that economy? They buy less of what? Of everything, exactly right. They buy less of everything than they would have to because the price of that particular thing is set arbitrarily high. And by arbitrarily, I mean the price is not set by the consumer. The only one in a position to make a determination as to what the relative value of this thing is to me. And because if it's an absolute necessity and there is no competition in that area, which often is the case, then it means that everyone in that economy suffers in some sense, to some degree, because of a lack of competition there. So this kind of competition, open competition, an acknowledgement of the curse, that survival force, which is active in the economy all the time, is best for the whole. Now, we might think that it's not best for the individual grocer who isn't able to compete with the grocer down the street. But that's only a temporary situation for the grocer. Understandably, in our imperfect world, there are no perfect institutions or certainly no perfect perfection in the economy. But even for someone who finds himself on the losing end of that competition, what does that then do for that individual? It forces that individual to improve. They're forced to improve. Not forced by some external person who puts a gun to their head and says, you better improve. They're forced by virtue of the survival force itself. I must improve. I must improve my quality. I must improve my costs. I have to improve. And this item number 3 there, which I jumped over, this kind of situation is a situation in which people are the most concerned with the opinions of everyone else in the economy. Why are people so concerned with the opinions of everybody else in the economy? Because they are dependent upon them. For me to survive, I must make sure that you are satisfied, you're pleased, that you're able to make it yourself. So, that kind of situation in a fallen world, in a world where there is scarcity, whether we like it or not, this kind of situation, when there's open, honest, known, in terms of the values, known competition, it is best for everyone in the economy. Now, that last idea, that power to fail, what does failure do? More and more today, we're getting in a situation where we as a society are deciding that we should not have failure. Failure of a business should not be allowed. But what happens when we take away the potential of failure in an economy? Well, what we do is we take away, essentially, the power of the survival force. We take that away. But what we're doing is we're doing that arbitrarily because there's already scarcity. We cannot, there's no way for us to do away with scarcity. That's the way the world is now because of the fall and the curse. And what we do then, by taking away the power of the survival force, is we weaken the economy for everyone. Because what happens in an industry when there is no fear of failure? What happens? Quality goes down and prices go up. It's like clockwork because it's human nature. If I don't have to worry about the survival force, I would rather not. But that's not good for everybody else. Because now what they're dealing with is less quality, lower quality than otherwise, and higher prices than otherwise. And that's no good for anyone in our situation. Remember? Not because we would like to design it this way where there is scarcity in the world, but that's what we are left with as a result of the fall, as a result of sin. So, that power of failure creates urgency. It facilitates change and improvement. And now we see, this is important for us to understand too, that where the first force created a moral imperative, the creation force creates this moral imperative for us to use everything that God has given us for His glory and for the work of the commission He's given us to subdue the earth. Right? That's the first moral imperative we have. But now because of the fall and the curse and the survival force, we have a second moral imperative. That moral imperative is that we need to accept responsibility. Our engagement in the struggle is an acceptance of our own individual responsibility for the situation as it now exists. That is, we are taking personal responsibility for the scarcity that is in the world because of the fall, which is because of our sin. So we have to accept responsibility for ourselves. And that's where a passage like 2 Thessalonians 3:10 comes into play. If a man will not work, he shall not eat. Because we're mean people? No. Because each of us has a moral responsibility to engage in the struggle against the curse. And if an individual is going to say, not me, I don't bear any responsibility for that, then Paul says, well, then that person shouldn't eat. What is Paul doing by saying, what kind of position is he putting this individual in? By saying, if a man will not work, he shall not eat. What's he doing? What is he causing him to feel? Survival. The survival force, that's right. No one is immune from this. If you would like to remove yourself from it, fine. Then we're not going to give you anything so that you can, by the virtue of the pain in your stomach, understand that you are not special. All of us have the same responsibility, a moral imperative to engage this situation. But we're not just responsible for ourselves. We're responsible for our families. In 1 Timothy 5:8, if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for the members of his immediate family, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. How can it be that those of us who know the truth, who understand the incredible extent of the effect of sin in this world, could deny our own responsibility to supply the needs of our own relatives and especially our own immediate family? That doesn't make any sense, he says. If you do that, you're worse than an unbeliever. But it's not just our family that we're responsible for. It's all who are truly needy. All who are truly needy. Galatians 2, verse 10. This is when Paul is talking to the church in Galatia about the gathering of the apostles and the elders there in the church of in Jerusalem to decide the question of whether Gentiles needed to be circumcised as well as the Jews had been previously in order to be saved. And he talks, of course, that the answer was no. And then he adds, all they asked was that we should continue to remember the poor, the very thing I was eager to do. This is only one example. We know that this idea of caring for those who are truly needy comes to us again and again and again and again. Now, if you put those texts together, what do you come up with? You come up with an understanding of taking care of the needy, which identifies who is needy. In other words, adding the previous passages to this passage, we see the individual responsibility for all those who can do it. And then we see the responsibility that we have to those who are truly needy, that is, those who cannot do it. Because there are certain things that are a result of the fall that stand in the way of people's ability to provide for themselves. But this last item is, I think, important. Your participation in the economy is already your greatest contribution to society. You taking the responsibility to utilize the gifts that God has given you, which He hasn't given me, to provide things that I can purchase from you and other people can purchase from you that I can't purchase from many other people, that and which you have to, and when you do that, you have to keep your costs low and keep your quality high. All that work is the best gift that you give to society. The best gift. But this idea of this struggle against the curse, this survival force, it expands the inequality that we can expect to find in society. It expands that. Jesus says, the poor you will always have with you. Why are we always going to have the poor with us? Well, because that's the way the world is. The world is broken. We're never going to be able to create the utopia where there isn't scarcity. That's the way it's going to be. So there's an inequality. That inequality is based upon ability. Some people have the ability to produce more than others. And if you are able to produce more than others, you are going to be of more value to society, objectively speaking, than others in the struggle now. We're talking economically. And therefore, you will receive more of the valuation of society, which comes in the form of money or resources or wealth. So that inequality is based in some part upon ability. Your health, your education, your intelligence, your age. It's also based upon availability. And that, in part, you know, you can see in looking at a first world situation versus a third world situation. There are some people in the third world who, even though they desperately feel this desire to engage everything that God has given them, the gifts that He has given them to subdue the earth, and they go about trying to do that the best way that they can, they are simply not given the opportunity to do that to any degree. And so there's necessarily that kind of inequality going on. Now, that much of that is an outgrowth of wickedness, but we're going to get to that in just a few minutes as to how that plays a role in the economy as well. Or this, your proximity to resources or opportunities, all those things play some kind of role in the particular ability you have to provide for yourself or in others. And it's also based upon effort. I mean, we can say we wish that this weren't the case, but some people work harder than other people. Some people work smarter than other people. And typically, those who work really hard and really smart become more prosperous. That's just the way it works. And that is, and as we saw last week, that is perfectly in line with the natural law as God created this world. I mean, He created the ground to bear fruit. Now, there's going to be thorns and thistles, obviously, but if you know the proper time to plant your crop, and if you know the proper time to weed your crop or spray your crop or water your crop or all those kinds of things, and you apply yourself to that and you work very hard at that, then you, 99 times out of 100, are going to have a better crop than those who don't do that. And that's that hard work is nothing to be ashamed of, obviously. It's something to be valued. I mean, all of us who have kids, don't we value our children's hard work? That's just an obvious kind of thing. Okay, so there's the creative force. It's out there. You see it in entrepreneurs, right? They're in inventions and all kinds of things all the time, that creative force at work in the economy. And aren't we glad that that's the case? Because how many things that have lifted the level of human existence, especially in the last 150 years, have come because of that creative force, that God-given creative force, having the freedom to express itself in the economy. So there's that. There's also the survival force, which lends itself to all sorts of different aspects of how to understand what's going on in the economy, and this idea of valuation, you know? Who is it who really has the proper perspective to place a value on anything in the economy? It's the person who's paying for it. But then there's a third force out in the economy, and that's the sinful force. And that is at work in the economy every day as well. Now, how do we define what the sinful force is? Well, one way to define it is to say that it attempts to escape the demands of the first force, that is the creative force, or the survival force. I don't want to do those things. I don't want to use what God has given me. I don't want to struggle and produce the things that I need by the sweat of my brow. I would rather find an easier way. I would rather live off of others in one of many different kinds of ways. Because any kind of wickedness in the economy is precisely that, living on the backs of others. So, some examples. Well, theft is the, everything can come underneath that for the most part, theft. These are some sections from Calvin's Institutes on his examination of the commandments, and this is with regard to the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal. He says, the purport is this, that injustice being an abomination to God, that's an important word because remember how we defined what justice is, economic justice, and the various ways that you can use that term? He says, injustice is an abomination to God. We must render to every man his due. In substance, then, the commandment forbids us to long after other men's goods and accordingly requires every man to exert himself honestly in preserving his own self, his own family, that kind of thing. For we must consider that what each individual possesses has not fallen to him by chance, but by the distribution of the sovereign Lord of all. We hear a lot today about redistribution. Here Calvin is saying that the distribution of things, whether it be their gifts or their abilities or the things that have grown from them, that is, unless those have been procured by deceit or fraud or some other kind of wickedness, have been distributed by the sovereign Lord of all, that no one can pervert his means to bad purposes, that is, another person's means, the things that he has, to bad purposes without committing a fraud on a divine dispensation. There are very many kinds of theft. One consists in violence, as when a man's goods are forcibly plundered and carried off. Another in malicious imposture, as when they are fraudulently intercepted. A third in the more hidden craft, which takes possession of them with a semblance of justice, that it's justice for you to take their stuff forcibly. And a fourth in sycophancy, which wiles them away under the pretense of donation, that is, some kind of fraud, saying, you know, there are those kinds of frauds that happen all the time, right? Anytime there's a major disaster around the world, how many different organizations aren't there that sprout up asking for donations and they have no intention of helping anyone with that money? But not to dwell too long in enumerating the different classes, we know that all the arts by which we obtain possession of the goods and money of our neighbors for sincere affection, substituting an eagerness to deceive or injure them in any way, are to be regarded as thefts. Though they may be obtained by an action at law, that is, it could be legal, the things that we do, a different decision is given by God. He sees the long train of deception by which the man of craft begins to lay nets for his more simple neighbor, until he entangles him in its meshes, sees the harsh and cruel laws by which the more powerful oppresses and crushes the feeble. That's oftentimes the situation in the third world, not only in the third world, but you see that when you go there, that there is not equality before the law, and because of that, those without the power are crushed and taken advantage of, sees the enticements by which the more wily baits the hook for the less wary. Though all these escape the judgment of man, that is, he thinks they're all just, they're okay, I guess that's just the way things are in the world, and no cognizance is taken of them, nor is the violation of this commandment confined to money or merchandise, this idea of stealing, or lands, but extends to every kind of right. And we defined rights as well earlier, right? A right. What is a right? We use that word in all sorts of different ways today. But the way that it's being used here, and the way that we use it when we're talking about justice, true justice, not just what's legal, but what's truly just, talking about natural rights, which is the sovereign ability to act, but extends to every kind of right when we take those away from people. That is, their right to life, their right to their possessions, their property, their right to their freedom to live out the cultural mandate within the bounds of other people's rights, of course. For we defraud our neighbors to their hurt if we decline any of the duties which we are bound to perform towards them. If an agent or an indolent steward wastes the substance of his employer or does not give due heed to the management of his property, if he unjustly squanders or luxuriously wastes the means entrusted to him, if a servant holds his master in derision, divulges his secrets, or in any way is treacherous to his life or his goods, if on the other hand a master cruelly torments his household, he is guilty of theft before God. Even tormenting your household, why is that? What is being stolen from them? Their humanity, their rights to their own life, that is the protection of it, and to their own freedom within, of course, the bounds, again, of other people's rights. He's guilty of theft before God. Since everyone who, in the exercise of his calling, performs not what he owes to others, keeps back or makes away with what does not belong to him. So this idea of theft, which is the definition of economic injustice, and it's not just about money, it's about that which rightfully belongs to another person, beginning with their person and their freedom to live, to exercise the gifts that God has given them by subduing the earth and doing something useful with his life or her life. Well, inheritance is not an issue that I deal with specifically in this transitional material, but inheritance, biblically speaking, is universally seen to be a blessing that a parent is able to give to their children. That inheritance then needs to be used wisely before God, just as any other kinds of earnings are used. But inheritance is a blessing that a parent is able to give to their children. When an inheritance can work contrary to the sovereignty of others. Right. Well, the divine right of kings would not be a biblical doctrine. Remembering our definitions of justice and what economic justice, how that word is used in various ways. One of the ways that we use that word is the way things ought to be. Okay? Saying, how can this be justice when this person has 100 and this person has 10? Right? That's one way that we use that word. Another way that we use that word is with regard to describing economic activities. And say either that is a just or an unjust economic activity. I have never found a biblical passage that indicates that an inheritance creates injustice, economic injustice. But that again, and we'd be good to go back and review those definitions of justice, but in order to be able to finish what we've got here, we'll have to just continue going. But that information is available, John. I can talk to you about those definitions later. Calvin continues with this. He says, "This commandment, therefore, we shall duly obey if, contented with our own lot, we study to acquire nothing but honest and lawful gain. If we long not to grow rich by injustice, nor to plunder our neighbor of his goods, that our own may thereby be increased. If we hasten not to heap up wealth cruelly wrung from the blood of others. If we do not, by means lawful and unlawful, with excessive eagerness, scrape together whatever may glut our avarice or meet our prodigality," okay, our desire for wild living. This is the conclusion that he draws here. "On the other hand, let it be our constant aim faithfully to lend our counsel and aid to all so as to assist them in retaining their property. Or if we have to do with the perfidious or crafty, let us rather be prepared to yield somewhat of our right than to contend with them." There he's talking about when Paul talks about the believers going to court against other believers because they have been wronged. And he says, why not rather be wronged? This is who he's referring to here by the perfidious or crafty. Let us rather be prepared to yield somewhat of our right than to contend with them, not demand that we be given what truly belongs to us. but rather entrust that to God. And not only so, but let us contribute to the relief of those whom we see under the pressure of difficulties, assisting their want out of our abundance. So, theft of its various varieties is the major expression of the sinful force in the economy. And the second part of that expression of the sinful force in the economy is sloth. And we have already gone through several passages specifically within the Proverbs of identifying that aspect. So, those are the three economic forces, okay? The creation force, the survival force, and the sinful force. And now what we have to do, we're going to take a break here for just a few minutes, but what we're going to do after the break is we're going to look at the role of the state in those matters. What is it that the state is supposed to be doing as far as God's concerned with regard to these three forces, right? Because if we're talking about the state activity within the economy, what we're talking about is the state's activity in this thing wherein these three forces are at work: the creative force, the survival force, and the sinful force. What is it supposed to be doing? How does that help us better understand the biblical teachings on the role of the state there in the economy? And then we'll be able to see the place of charity, its purposes, its nature, and our call to its work. The role of the state is important for us because as we started this class discussing, one of the reasons that this class and this topic is very important for us to examine together and to search the scriptures about is because economics is in so many ways the issue of our time, not just in the world around us as we see our own nation struggling economically, but much of the rest of the world struggling economically as well. But it's also an issue in the church because more and more, and especially as the Accra Confession expresses, coming right out of the Reformed churches, there is a movement within the church that is of the opinion that giving that it's the Christian perspective on charity or on economic justice to have the state be the dispenser of that charity. Okay, that is a growing belief in the church, but obviously the perspective of our class and of the scriptures on these issues is that that is not at all the case. And that's what we want to talk about now. Exactly what is the role of the state with regard to economic activities? The role of the state is to restrain force three, that is the sinful force, in order to secure an atmosphere where forces one and two can be free to accomplish their relative purposes in everyone's life. It's not to do away with either of those forces, because we already saw that there's a moral imperative, right, for each and every individual to engage those forces, to live that out, to engage the creative force, to live out the creative force in them. We have a moral imperative, and we're held accountable by God if we do not use what he has given us to subdue the earth, rule the earth, contribute by making things of value, and especially after the curse, we have a moral imperative to be participants in that as well, in some sense. So not to undo those things. We undo those things, we break that moral imperative, but also we get in the way of economic activity that is best for everybody. Well, everybody who's prepared to accept force one and force two, that is. If you're not prepared to accept that those are forces in the economy, then yeah, that won't have the same effect in your life. Paul, in Romans 13, he says, everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror. Now, this is by design. This is why God instituted them. We all know that rulers have held terror for a lot of people who have done right. But what he's talking about is the authorities, that is, the positions of authority that God has established, the state being one of the central positions of authority that God has established for a certain purpose. And according to that purpose, rulers hold no terror for those who do right, those who do what is moral, those who answer God's moral call and follow it, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and he will commend you. For he is God's servant to do you good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword for nothing. He is God's servant, an agent of wrath, to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, that is, it's going to hurt if you do, but also because of conscience, because God tells you to. He goes on, he says, this is also why you pay taxes. What is why you pay taxes? What did he just talk about? What was the role of the state that he just outlined, which is the reason why we pay taxes? The particular activity that the state is engaged in by God's design, which we pay taxes for, is for the state to punish wrongdoing. Wrongdoing in whose eyes? In God's eyes, right? That's what the state is put in place for, to punish the wrongdoer in God's eyes, not just in the state's eyes, the wrongdoer. So if we have this moral imperative to live out the creational force, and we have this moral imperative to accept responsibility and engage ourselves survival force, engaging ourselves in those things is part of our moral response to God. It's a definition then of right conduct, economically speaking. Now, what tool is it that the state has? The state is only described as having one tool, which is the sword. And there aren't too many things. Now, it's obviously both literal and figurative, but there aren't too many things that you use a sword for. It's for punishing. So the work of the state is to restrain through threat and punishment. Restrain from what? Restrain from unjust activity, wrong activity. But again, by whose definition? By God's definition. So through threat, and that is the setting of laws, right? It says, do not mix your honey with water. In other words, if you're going to say, well, you can if you say, look, we've got 90% honey here. If you want to market it that way, have at it. But don't go saying that you've got 100% honey when it's not 100% honey. Okay, there are laws against that kind of thing and similar kinds of things to restrain through the threat then, and then also, of course, the punishment when people step out of those moral boundaries, when they start to steal from other people. So, what are the expectations that the state then has to have? Well, that's where we have to get back to our definitions of justice here. In the way that we use this term, when we say, what is justice, economically speaking? One of the ways that we use that term is when we talk about the way things ought to be. Okay? And we say, a just society, economically speaking, would be one in which, fill in the blank. We use the word just to refer to that kind of ideal situation for a society, economically speaking. But we also use the word just or justice in the second way. Justice, we're giving it a superscript too, which refers to private economic activity that exists within the moral or the natural law of God. That is, it's private economic activity that is being engaged in answer to both the creational mandate, the cultural mandate, the creative force, and the survival force, taking responsibility for ourselves, our families, and for the genuinely needy, that kind of economic activity, within the moral or natural law, not unjust activity, not stealing from anybody, not oppressing anybody, not doing that, but engaging in just, in God's eyes, again, economic activity. It's not just necessarily because it's legal, but it's genuinely just in God's eyes. So it's private economic activity that conforms to the moral natural law. That's the second way that we use the word justice in terms of economic activity. And then there's this third one, which is related also to actions, But these are actions of a public nature. These are actions by the state. And we say, we are going to do justice. What do we mean by that? We mean that we, collectively, as a state, are going to make things the way they ought to be. So, we said last week that these three things have to complement each other. They can't work against each other. In other words, if you're going to define just economic activities as those activities that exist or conform to the moral or natural law of God, then it wouldn't make much sense for you to say that you're doing justice by punishing people who engage in those activities. How can you make the case that you're doing justice to people who are living within the moral and natural law of God in their economic activities? How is that doing justice? Except that you say, our doing this is making things more the way they ought to be. But you have a problem there if you define the way things ought to be in such a definition that these two things don't go together. In other words, if you say the way things ought to be in a society economically is some definition which isn't necessarily going to complement what just economic activity is, private activity, then what you're going to be regularly doing is, by the power of the state, punishing people who are doing justice in this way, being responsible for themselves, using their gifts to glorify God, contributing to the lives of others in the economy, all that kind of thing, because they're doing so, or the activities in the economy, aren't somehow creating what we think things ought to be like. So, biblically speaking, what might we say, how would we define the way things ought to be economically? Now, we could do that in terms of a pretend world or the world to come where there will be no scarcity. We could do that, but that's not living in the real world. It wouldn't do us much good to say, we believe that a just economy today is one in which there is no scarcity, that everyone has everything that they want whenever they want it. Or you could say it a different way, that no one feels the pressures of the survival force in their lives. You could say it that way. But if you did that, you would be defining the way things ought to be contrary to what the Bible tells us our perspective needs to be with regard to both the creation force in our lives and the survival force in our lives. So what we need to define that as then, biblically speaking, is that there ought to be opportunity for all to fully live into the created force, the creation force, that is the cultural mandate, and the survival force, that no one should be forcibly kept from either of those things. Why not? Because they must engage themselves in those two things to be living morally in an economic sense before God, if they're at all able to do that, right? Now, we've already talked about the fact that some people, by virtue of their situation and other aspects of the repercussions of the fall, aren't able to do that, but those are not the rule. Those are the exceptions to the rule. So, these are the different ways that we talk about justice. So, when we say that we ask the question, what are the expectations of the state? The expectations of the state, or the things that it must focus itself on in terms of keeping things in within certain boundaries, is this justice number two. And that's what justice has always been. That is, justice, doing justice, has always been about judging and either punishing or not punishing individual activity, not your state in life. If the cops came to your house tonight and took you away, you would say, what are the charges? And they would say, you live in a big house. What? Wait a minute. That's a punishable offense? No, punishable offenses are activities. It could be that you defrauded people of millions of dollars, which allowed you to live in a big house. Well, that's a different situation. Then, obviously, they have broken this idea of justice in God's eyes. That's punishable, obviously. That's what God puts the state in power to do, is punish those things. So that is the, and needs to be, biblically speaking, the focus of the role of the state within the economy then. So to restrain, either by threat or punishment, the sinful force at work in the economy. The sinful force. That doesn't mean that all inequality is going to go away, because a lot of that is by design in terms of God's gifts to one person over another person, but we'll get to that in a minute. How does God intend to deal with that in a healing way, in a way that brings us together? So each person's natural rights need to be secured, their sovereign authority to act in an economic sense within the limits of the moral and natural law. So there are lots of passages that are quoted with regard to care for the poor, and they need to be quoted with regard to care for the poor, but there is not a single biblical passage that I've ever found, and if you can find one, I'd love to see it, that calls on the state to exercise charity. It often calls on the state to make sure that the rights of the poor to do these things are not taken away or diminished, that there should be no favoritism when it comes to the judging of these activities or the ability, the freedom to have those activities. But here in Leviticus 19, this passage is written directly to the judges of the people of Israel. You shall not do injustice in judgment. Well, what's injustice in judgment? You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. That means justice is judging your neighbor only on their actions and not on their identity. That is biblical justice of this nature here. Judging your neighbor fairly. And fairly is to judge all people equally based on their activities. Now, the power to lead the community into the positive aspects of the law are left to the church. Now, most of you probably know that the law is both negative and positive. The boundaries of economic activity are the freedoms of others. So in other words, if a right is the sovereign authority to act, that's what a right is. I, as an individual, have a sovereign authority to act with regard to holding on to my life. I want to live. And no one has the right to take that away from me. So the sovereign authority to act with regard to my life, with regard to my liberty and property, that is all extensions of my life, to freely use these things as I believe God is calling me to in my response to Him with all of my life, all of my gifts, all of my possessions, all of my abilities, everything. I want to use everything for Him. I need to be free to do that. That's a right. Most of the law, most of the moral law is designed in a negative way, which means that you are forbidden something. That is, you're not commanded to do something positive. You're forbidden from doing something negative. So we are forbidden from taking these away or doing anything that encroaches on another person's fundamental rights as human beings. But there's another aspect, there's another side of the law, which is the positive side of the law. And Calvin got into that a little bit when he was talking about the Eighth Commandment. Because the law is not only about restricting behaviors which deny these things to people. The law is also about, that is, the positive side of the law, which is not, I mean, you can use law in different ways too. The Old Testament moral law was of a negative variety. In other words, it restricted people from doing things that took these things away from other people. But they were already supposed to be getting the clue about that will of God, that it wasn't just about not doing the things that would restrict these things in the lives of others. It was also about giving yourself for the good of others.
Okay, that's the positive aspect of the law, or the place where charity lives. So not just refraining from doing things that would take these things away from my fellow man, but when I see my fellow man in need, utilizing things that God has given me in order to relieve that need. Okay, that's the positive side of the law. But where is the authority given, or where does the power come from in order to create or instigate the activities with regard to the positive side of the law? Well, that's not the state. And we'll see why in a second. That's the church. That's what the church, and by church I simply mean the moral word of proclamation in society. About what we, not just what we shouldn't be doing, but what we should be doing as those who know and love God. And what the Bible tells us about this positive side of the law is that it is crucially a matter of the heart. It's a matter of the heart. And so Paul says in 2 Corinthians 9:7, each man should give what he has decided in his heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. Okay, God's happy when we refrain from taking things away from other people. He's thrilled when we use what he has blessed us with to help others. But what thrills him about that is not just that property changes possession from us to them. What he's thrilled about is the heart of love that desires to relieve their suffering. That's what thrills God's heart. So when it comes to our offerings, this is why with the transition into the New Testament, it went from calculation to celebration. Right? The New Testament doesn't give us a calculation for what we're supposed to give. Right? And when we do our budget, we don't say, please hand in your 1040 on your way out of the service today so that we can calculate what you owe, and if you don't send it in, we're going to come and collect it. No, because it wouldn't be an offering then. And it wouldn't be an expression of the heart then. It wouldn't be an expression of the positive side of the law then. It wouldn't be love then. This is not possible by force. Achieving God's desires in charity is not possible by force. In 2 Corinthians 9:13 and 14, it says, because of the certain, this is just a little while after that previous passage. Listen to the way Paul talks here. Because of the service by which you have proved yourselves. Now remember, this offering was a particular offering that was being raised in order to help relieve their brothers and sisters in and around Jerusalem because of the difficulty that they had there, the famine that they had had there, and the horrible situation that those believers were in. Because of the service by which you have proved yourselves. Proved what? What are they proving with their offering? Their love. They're proving their love. They couldn't prove their love unless it was freely offered. Because of that, what will happen? Men will praise God for the obedience that accompanies your confession of the gospel of Christ. The things that you are doing freely confirm your confession of the gospel of Christ. And when people see that, when they receive that, they will praise God because of your testimony, the proof of your belief in the gospel, and for your generosity in sharing with them and with everyone else. And in their prayers for you, their hearts will go out to you because of the surpassing grace God has given you. Thanks be to God for this indescribable, should be, not indescribably, indescribable gift. What's happening here? What is God accomplishing by the free gift of these offerings from one group of people to another group of people? He is accomplishing his glory, and he is accomplishing the ties and bonds of love that are established, which bring them closer together. That's what charity does. True charity glorifies God, and people glorify God when they receive it because they know that it was given out of love. Love for God and love for them. But it also ties people together in the bonds of love. Those things do not happen through force. It can't happen through force. Altruism is not a meaningful concept where there is no genuinely private property. Have you ever thought about that before? Why is sacrifice the highest good? Why is sacrifice the highest good? Because you don't need to do it. It belongs to you. It belongs to you. And sacrifice is a testimony that your love is such that you are willing to give up that which genuinely belongs to you because of your love for others. Christ's sacrifice was the extreme act of love because he said, "No one takes it away from me, but I lay it down willingly for you." So, in Acts 4:32, it says, "All the believers were united in heart and mind. They loved each other, and they felt that what they owned was not their own, that is, not to be kept as their own. So they shared everything they had." Now, this passage is a powerful passage about the sharing that is to be going on within the body of Christ. It's an incredibly powerful passage about that. But it assumes something. It assumes that they owned it. If they didn't own it, how would it be a sacrifice? How would it be an expression of love if they didn't own it? They freely brought it. That was the testimony of love that they gave. And that final point there on that slide, there's not a single biblical passage that calls on the state to alleviate the suffering of the poor, only to defend their rights. That is, their right to sovereignly act in these areas too and not be oppressed. So, charity must, like the worship of our response to the creative force and our response to the survival force or the reality of the curse and scarcity and our need to provide for ourselves, our families, and those in need by the sweat of our brow, charity too needs to be freely given to be glorifying to God and to accomplish his purposes. So the question of charity then, the biblical command is clear as we referenced it in 1B7:1C. I'm not sure if you'll be able to follow that, okay, but you can go back and find that in the outline. But the critical question is, what is the goal of charity? We've already talked a little bit about that, but this gets us back to a question that we asked already 2 weeks ago. We have two options. We have prosperity and we have provision. What is it that we are supposed to be working for or trying to bring about within society, within the economy? Is it prosperity for all? Or is it simply provision for all? And what is the goal then of charity? Because charity, right, charity is our activities, our individual private activities of trying to make things more like they should be. More like they should be, to alleviate some of the suffering in the situation after the fall. But is our goal then simply to provide provision for people, or should the goal of charity be to lead people into prosperity? That's an important question. Well, let's define prosperity. Prosperity is the state of flourishing, thriving, good fortune. Yeah, well, this is a secular thing, right? Good fortune and or successful social status. Prosperity often encompasses wealth. This is important. But also includes other factors which are independent of wealth to varying degrees, such as happiness and health. Now, this is important because prosperity is a very biblical concept. We started there a couple of weeks ago, but not in the sort of the health and wealth gospel kind of way that prosperity is a very biblical doctrine. It's very biblical in another sense. But it's important for us to see that prosperity involves wholeness. That is, it's not just about wealth or material provision. That's not all prosperity is about. Prosperity is more than that. It's about wholeness. And so prosperity involves balance, as we'll see. Truly prosperous people or prosperous communities have a balance within that community of various things. And this idea of prosperity is directly linked to the biblical notion of shalom. Shalom. It's translated peace, but it means a very comprehensive kind of peace. And in your materials, you have there on page seven, I think, for you. Page seven, you've got an excerpt from Irbin's Bible Dictionary on peace. Let's just read through that a second. Peace, the Hebrew is shalom, okay? A state of wholeness or of well-being and security, embracing both the physical and spiritual dimensions and relating not only to the individual, but also to entire communities and relationships among persons. Working for prosperity or shalom, and you'll see the connection between prosperity and shalom in just a second, is more than about the individual. It's about bringing individuals together in a kind of relationship that benefits all. Peace, as experienced by communities, includes economic prosperity. It talks about that in Psalm 147 and Haggai 2:9 and others. And political security. That means that the borders are secure and that there are no enemies breathing down the people's necks. Although peace may be attained through either military victory or surrender, peace is in the biblical sense, often involves more than simply the classical Greek connotation of eirene, which is another Greek word for peace, which, as the cessation or absence of hostility. The one way to think about peace is just no war. But shalom isn't that kind of peace. It's not a no war kind of peace. It's a fundamental wholeness, all of life kind of peace. A warrior returning safely from battle has preserved health and so is truly in peace. It's one of the ways that it's used. Go in peace is a common farewell to persons going on a journey that might involve difficulty. It occurs also with the sense of restoration to wholeness of a relationship or health or of forgiveness. All peace is said to come from the sovereign God. He's the giver of peace. He's the giver of this kind of whole life peace, which also has to do with economic prosperity, because that's one component of a whole life which is being lived in peace, in shalom, with God and with one another. For this reason, the experience of peace is dependent on righteousness. We can't have shalom in society without righteousness. But where are you going to go to for a definition of righteousness? You have to go to God. Obedience and justice in all these ways. God's covenant with his people is sometimes called a covenant of peace. The fundamental quality of eschatological hope, that is, of the new kingdom, of the coming world, is peace like that which is not experienced in the present age. Therefore, no matter what degree of shalom we're able to live into right now, it's only a foretaste of the kind of shalom that we will have in the eschatological age. But it encompasses all of these different areas of life. The coming deliverer is called the Prince of Peace. As sin originating in the human heart disrupts the entire creation, so in the age to come, all life will be reconstructed in peace. The coming of Christ and the sending of the Spirit are interpreted as the coming of eschatological peace. That is, we already now taste of that peace that will be in the world in life to come. The gospel is the gospel of peace. In it, peace with God is made available, and God is known as the God of peace. But conflict and insecurity are expected to continue on earth until the consummation of this peace with the return of Christ. Christ is our peace in that he has created the environment in which hostility can be replaced by new relationships. No longer violent relationships, no longer immoral relationships, no longer relationships where we oppress and use one another in the economy as well as in other areas of our relationship, but have moral relationships there. Those who establish peace will be called sons of God. Again, this kind of whole life kind of peace. Peace is the goal of Christian relationships with all people, including fellow Christians and the church at large. So we see that This idea of shalom is an idea of a kind of prosperity, which is all of life. And if you remember the Deuteronomy 28 passage that we looked at a couple of weeks ago, Deuteronomy 28, when God says, look, if you will live morally before me, these are the things that I will do for you. These are the blessings that you'll enjoy as a community. Those blessings involved their harvest, plentiful harvest, involved the health and growth of their livestock and all those kind of things, as well as many other aspects of community life. All of those things were wrapped up in one whole that was, he was saying, if you will live morally before me, what you will be able to experience, even in this world, is a taste of shalom involving all these different aspects. And when you do, when you live that way with each other, what you will find is that the bonds between you will be strengthened, and true community will be the product, will be the end result. Those are the kinds of things that are created when you live morally with one another within my law, including, of course, economically. Now, prosperity, again, it's got this whole life aspect to it, but prosperity also assumes investment or participation, which goes back to the creation force and the survival force, right? Everybody engaging in those two things. Prosperity assumes that you're doing something. Prosperity is the creation of something that comes from moral activity. So if you're saying that you're working for prosperity, or you're experiencing prosperity, or what you want to have in a community is prosperity, what you are saying is you want to have the result of each individual in that community living morally before God in every area of their life, including economically. Prosperity assumes involvement by people. And prosperity then meets all three moral imperatives. Not only the moral imperative of the cultural mandate and the moral imperative of the survival force and our responsibility there, but part of that, remember, part of our responsibilities because of the fall and the curse are not only to care for ourselves and not only to care for our families, but also to care for those who are in genuine need. So that idea of charity is already embedded in that survival situation where we need to survive and we need to help others survive. And this idea of prosperity then meets all three moral imperatives, because if we are working for prosperity in the lives of the needy, what are we working for? We are working for a situation where they too, in some real sense, are taking a place in the community. In other words, when the deacons get a call that someone is in need, the deacons do a lot more than say, how much do you need? Let us write you a check. They say, tell me about your situation. And they utilize that opportunity to disciple people into some aspect of the fullness of a life of prosperity. That is, a life of experiencing the fullness that God intends for us to have and to share with one another in community. And one other thing that we need to remember is that as we encourage in this idea of prosperity, as we encourage the activities with regard to the creational force, that idea of our creativity and innovation and all those kinds of things, we necessarily reduce the suffering that is associated with the survival force or the curse. The more of those things that are going on, even as we experience, the distance between us today and true destitution is a lot farther than it would have been 300 years ago, in part because of the vast amount of activity that has been going on with regard to this creational mandate, this creational force of living into the fullness of this kind of living out what God has, the gifts that God has given us. So assistance with regard to prosperity involves various things. It provides a path toward wholeness. That's what we're at with for people. We're not just working to have some of their needs met. We are working for them to live into a kind of wholeness of life. which is if you work with people in need, that is one of the things that slaps you up against the face, is that their lives, in so many cases, are empty. It's not just that they don't have enough money for the electric bill, but there's an emptiness about life, and much more so as that need increases, and it goes on and on and on. A fostering of the image of God in them. And so we move to the second one, the second option, which is provision. Should we just be working for provision for all? And more it sounds like that's what people say. What we ought to be, we shouldn't be so much about prosperity, because people automatically link prosperity with greed. If that's the case, then shalom must be linked with greed, but it isn't. It's simply linked to the fullness of life as God desires us to experience and enjoy it with Him and with one another. But provision, let's define provision. Provision is simply subsistence living. In other words, what we should be aiming for with regard to charity is just to make sure everybody has enough to live. But that reduces economic life to having rather than producing or being involved, as the creation mandate calls, or the cultural mandate calls, and also the personal responsibility of living in the curse. All right? We reduce economic life in people's lives to simply having provisions. And there's no expectation of participation if our only goal is provision. And so it fails to meet the moral imperatives. Simple provision does not meet the moral imperatives of their living into the fullness of what it means to be created in God's image and to take that personal responsibility as best they can to struggle against the curse with the rest of the community. Assistance. When we're talking about just trying to meet provision, what does assistance look like? It provides just basic material subsistence, and it's a fundamental reduction of human value. If what we're saying in charity is the only thing that these people need is subsistence, then what we are doing is we are reducing their value as human beings by not clearly calling them into living out what they've been created to live out. We all know, those of us who have ever worked a day in our lives, we know the kind of satisfaction that comes from contribution. And that is something that we rob people of if our only goal is provision for them and not a furthering of their understanding and living into the fullness of the image of God in them. So a reduction of human fulfillment then, because we don't get to experience that kind of thing. A diminishing ability to fulfill the cultural mandate and the survival force. You see that as that kind of thing, this idea of only aiming for provision as it just continues to create this kind of empty living. People lose their even ability to engage these kinds of things, to fulfill those. An increasing sense of entitlement of others' property, and a slow death of humanity and of true culture. If you look at places around the world where this idea of provision being the aim, the goal, in those kinds of communities among the poor, what you have is a slow death of humanity there and of true culture. And culture, I don't mean tuxedos and cellos. I'm talking about the kinds of things that are developed as people engage the cultural mandate. So, while those who favor more of a socialistic kind of approach, that is state-sponsored charity, will often speak of working for prosperity for all, the structure of socialism cannot achieve this goal. It cannot achieve prosperity for all. That's not the way it functions, because it assumes prosperity can simply be shifted through a transfer of ownership. You cannot create prosperity in somebody's lives through a transfer of ownership. That's simply provision. You have to lead them into the fullness of living out the cultural mandate and against the curse if you're going to create prosperity in their lives. So just a transfer of ownership doesn't create that. It denies that wealth is created, and we don't have time to get into all that, but it's not, there is no wealth until somebody grabs some dirt and makes something out of it, or a tree and makes something out of it. It necessarily weakens the prosperity of any economy, is striving for provision rather than prosperity. That effect only increases in time. And that then, this leads, the natural outgrowth of that kind of idea leads to
more the idea that what we should be aiming for really is provision for all. So in other words, they start with, yeah, prosperity for all. But that kind of socialistic approach to things cannot create prosperity. It does. It just fundamentally cannot. And so people then say, well, maybe all we can hope for is provision for all. But then now all of a sudden we've got the wrong goal. And we're working against not only society, we're working against the people we're trying to help. This denies those moral imperatives. And the end of this is nothing short of death to various things. The freedom of man, the image of God in man, true communities of man, the living conditions of men, and their actual lives. I would love, I mean, I'm going to stop here in 3 minutes, but to do a study together of the unbelievable destitution created by aiming for provision for all makes your stomach turn. It doesn't work. And it's a matter of life and death. When we talk about working against a curse, struggling against a curse, we're talking about matters of life and death. Economic issues are matters of life and death, and when you get it wrong, people die. People die all the time. Yes, they do. But many more than have to die when we get matters of economics wrong. So, while the two options for the goal of charity are prosperity or provision, those two goals are tied necessarily to two respective means of achieving those goals. Freedom under God is the means to prosperity for all. That is, these freedoms. Freedom under God is the equation that leads to the goal of prosperity for all. Force under state is the means to provision for all. Necessarily. If provision for all is our goal, force under state must be the means. It will always work out that way. These are two diametrically opposed means, and they represent, therefore, two diametrically opposed destinations. Life and the things that go, that is, the fullness of life, a better fullness, a greater fullness of life, and death and its variants, its derivatives, the things that go with destitution and loss and scarcity and that kind of thing. So, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy, says Jesus. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. Now, there's a way in which people can utilize that passage in a health and wealth gospel. That's not the point. But the point is that when he says life to the full, that means shalom. That means peace. That means bonds of love with one another. That means prosperity in its right and godly sense. And the only way to have that is through the moral activities, both within the economy and in the other areas of our life that Christ leads us into. We're 4 minutes over time, but in closing, I just say this. Within the church today, there are many different opinions about these things. And, as we talked about some time ago, one would that we could just say, okay, we all disagree, so let's not talk about it. But we know that that's not possible. So the key is for us to talk about it in the sense of going back to the scriptures and identifying what is the truth with regard to these things? What are we supposed to stand for and what are we supposed to stand against? My desire is that all of us together would find conclusively what we need to stand for and what we need to stand against. Because we are regularly discerning the kinds of things that we should be doing out in the community. What kinds of things should we be advocating for out in the community? How can we bring about a better fullness of life? How can we bring about more shalom in the community in which we live as God's people? What kinds of things should we be working for? And as we can see, there are basically two approaches and they go in two opposite directions. And if we should choose wrong, we will be working against the community rather than for the community. All right, let's pray. Lord God, we desire, every single one of us, Lord, desires to live into the fullness of your will for us in every area of life.
and this no less than any of the others. Lord, we thank you for giving us gifts. We thank you for giving us abilities, opportunities to acquire knowledge of one sort or another, and then to be able to have the health and the strength and the freedom to engage those things, both to supply our own needs, the needs of our families, but also the needs of those who are truly in need outside of our families. Lord, we pray that your people, not only here in this place, but all around the world, would fully grow up into all that you want us to be and do in this area, that there might be transformation in people's lives that is more than they ever could have dreamed, not only in a financial way, but in a wholeness way, and in bonds of community that are only created through the hearts of your people reaching out into the hearts of others. So Lord, lead us and guide us. Help us each to take our place, and on a daily basis, O Lord, live with everything you have given us for your glory and for the good of all. In your name we pray. Amen.